Welcome to the I Spy with My MyoEye podcast. I am your host, Brittany Murphy. I am a certified oral facial myologist, registered dental hygienist, and lifelong learner. My goal with this podcast is to bring you up to date in current literature and expand your knowledge of oral facial myofunctional disorders so that together we can get to the root cause of the problem. You ask, we'll answer by collaborating with true pioneers and specialties associated with the myo world. Join me on this journey as we dive into the life-altering world of tethered oral tissues and airway space. Let's do this thing. Quick disclaimer, all content expressed on this podcast are the views and opinions of the speakers and is for informational purposes only. You should not rely on this information as a substitute for, nor does it replace, professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Because every person is so unique, you should always consult with your specialized healthcare professional. Lisa is an IBCLC and certified nurse midwife in private practice in Staten Island, New York. Lisa worked for 28 years at Staten Island University Hospital before establishing her private practice in 2015. At the hospital, she co-founded and coordinated the Breastfeeding Initiative and worked in collaboration with the NYC Department of Health on efforts towards achieving the baby-friendly designation. Currently, Lisa offers courses for parents and professionals on the topic of breastfeeding and tongue tie. She produces the weekly show, The Tongue Tie Experts Podcast, and provides education to parents and professionals through the Tongue Tie Experts brand on Facebook and Instagram. She's the author of the book, It Shouldn't Hurt to Nurse Your Baby, Healing the 6 Most Common Causes of Nipple Pain. She loves to lecture and educate the world on the importance of breastfeeding for the health of infants in the developing airway. Personally, Lisa is happily married to her college sweetheart and has raised 7 children and is a proud grandma. She enjoys reading, watching the New York Mets, traveling, walking in nature, and spending time with her 2 spoiled Shih Tzus. Good morning, Lisa. Thank you for coming on the podcast and chatting with me today. So welcome.
Thank you, Brittany. I'm so excited to be here with you. It's something I've wanted to do for a while. I've been, you know, following your podcast and it's very exciting to be here.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I'm very excited to have you here. And I'd love if you want to start by telling the listeners a little bit about yourself, how you really got into the world of tethered oral tissues and all of that stuff.
Okay. So I am, as before we hit record, we were chatting and I said, I'm old. I've been doing this. I've been taking care of moms and babies for a really, really long time. I started out as a nurse and I always wanted to work maternity. And I finally got there and I worked OB as a nurse. I worked the nursery. I worked OB. Always had a very high interest in natural birthing and breastfeeding, even though it wasn't in style back then. It just kind of, you know, whenever there was something about it, that's where I went. Yep. So I decided to become a midwife. And in the midst of my midwifery training, I had to do a research class and I needed a project. And I chose a project about breastfeeding and skin to skin. And I'm sure most people know what skin to skin is. It's when the baby's born, you put the baby right on you. Now it's a regular occurrence and whatever. But back then it wasn't, right? It was like radical. Like, what do you mean? We're going to let the mother hold the baby with no clothes on. So I did that research project and I sort of got known as the breastfeeding person at the hospital because we didn't have any lactation consultants. So I worked my way up, did my training, got my IBCLC at this just about the same time I got my midwifery degree. And people started sending all their babies to me and, you know, all the mamas and babies who wanted to breastfeed that were having problems. And fast forward a little bit, I had 1 week of 3 babies that I could not help with all of my experience and all of my tools. And I started hearing whisperings and hintings about tongue tie. And as a midwife, I was like very skeptical because I'm non-interventionary. You know, I don't want to do anything that doesn't have to be done. And I couldn't imagine. I was like all the skeptics I face today. Yep. I couldn't imagine having to do something to a baby. The baby should just be able to breastfeed.
Right.
But I ran across these babies. And then I had one mom who came to me and said, I brought my baby for a tongue tie release and look, and all of a sudden this baby could nurse. Mm-hmm. So it just sent me down the rabbit hole of learning, going to conferences, shadowing other professionals, deep dive into it. And it turned out that I was the only person locally to me that recognized it. So I became, it just sort of happened that I became the specialist in my area about tongue tie. So that's basically my story. And it just keeps happening. You know, I keep expanding my universe. You know, I have the Tongue Tie Experts podcast now. I teach parents and professionals about tongue tie. It's just, it's one of my loves. I have lots of loves, but it's the love that has called me the most. So that's, you know, that where I feel like I had the most need. So that was a long answer, but.
No, that was a fabulous answer. We absolutely want to know, you know, your journey. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, I feel like there's a lot of controversy, even in the IBCLC world on tether oral tissues. Can you talk a little bit about that and why it's not, you know, like not all IBCLCs treat the same as you do?
Right. Well, I think that part of it is, you know, the same situation that I had. I didn't learn about it in school. Now, I have degrees in midwifery, nursing, and special training for lactation. And I learned, if I learned altogether 10 minutes about tongue tie, it was a lot, right? So even in midwifery, and if there's any midwives listening to me, please, I'm not trying to insult you, but we didn't know what we didn't know even about breastfeeding itself. Right. So forget about what we didn't know about tongue tie. I knew very little about breastfeeding from my midwifery education and my nursing education. And I was taking care of new babies and moms, and I didn't know anything about breastfeeding. Right. So it was a little crazy. So the other thing that happens is that if you get used to doing something a certain way, some people don't like expanding their knowledge. So I find that less with nursing and, you know, allied health professionals, more with doctors, which, you know, again, not meaning to insult anybody.
Of course.
But if you're used to learning a certain, doing things a certain way, and you know all your tricks and you feel like you're not included, you know, oh, well, I'm not in that group, so I'm not going to learn that. That's one of the things. Then the other thing is people who want to be strictly evidence-based in the fact of randomized controlled studies and less on what clinical evidence and experience hold for us are missing the boat, you know, and I'm all for research. As I said, that's how I got started in this with a research project. I'm all for it, but it's really, really, really hard. Almost impossible to have randomized control studies on infants, right? Because what are we going to do? Oh, we're going to treat you and we're not going to treat you.
Right.
So it's improving, and there's prospective studies happening, and people are, you know, keeping track of their numbers and things like that. And there is research going on in different professional organizations. There's a research project going on in, anyway, research groups are, it's happening. It's starting,
right?
But it's not an old, you know, it takes a long time for that research to get trickled down, you know?
I'm sure, you know, you've been doing this for quite some time now, and you're very trusted, you know, in your field. Do you still, cause I know, like, as a myofunctional therapist, you know, we treat patients all across Connecticut. So all different pediatrician offices that we're dealing with. You still struggle sometimes where families seek out the opinion of their pediatrician, or maybe an ENT and ENT or pediatrician doesn't agree with you? And if so, or even in the past, maybe earlier in your career when this happened, what are your recommendations for those professionals that are struggling with other providers disagreeing with them?
I love this question. And I wish I could say I don't struggle anymore. I still struggle. And sadly, it's not my struggle. It's the family struggle, because families want to trust their doctors. So I've sort of evolved my recommendations. I have the unique experience, you know, most IBCLCs don't have a medical degree. So I have a medical degree. I can diagnose and refer. So I don't need the approval of a doctor to say a certain thing, but right. I want to be friends with everyone and I want everyone on board. Right. I suggest to parents, if they don't agree, to just trust their own instincts, mm-hmm. you know, and if a professional is hitting the wall with a certain provider, I think the best thing to do is either stick with the providers that you are comfortable with and suggest those providers to your patients. Like if, you know, we get a lot of questions about who should I use as a pediatrician, right? So there are certain pediatricians that are more friendly towards lactation itself, not even tongue tie, lactation itself, right? Breastfeeding itself. So that kind of thing. But I always like to empower parents and tell them, you know, I don't even want them to listen to me blindly.
Right.
I'm all about education. So I don't want them to do something because I told them to. Mm-hmm. I want them to take all the information in and then make an informed decision. And honestly, I've had many, many parents who've had the tongue tie procedure and their pediatrician never, ever even knew, mm-hmm. which doesn't do anything for helping this field.
Right.
But those parents are taking care of their own baby.
They're trusting their gut and their...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, it's not just the actual release. I mean, you would be surprised at how many pediatricians feel uncomfortable with the thought of, you know, for lack of a better term, body work for babies. Because I start with other therapies, if possible, for a baby. I don't go straight to let's release the tongue, right? So in your field, in the older kids, and adults, you're talking about myo and maybe mm-hmm. other physical modalities. For me, it's exercises, it's PT, OT, chiropractor, depending on what I feel and what the parents are able to work with and, you know, financially can afford, but usually we're doing some sort of manual therapy first. And I like to get that tongue moving a little bit if they're breastfeeding or if they're bottle feeding, get them back to breast if possible before the procedures. So it's never a quick fix, almost never. And it's not always like, this is what we're going to do. Go do it. It's more like, let's learn about it. You know, talk to your pediatrician if you feel like you have to. But right. the pediatricians mostly are not on board. And I even have one particular pediatrician who has slandered me, but I haven't caught him. I've mm-hmm. heard like second degree knowledge about, you know,
now
how evil I am and all that.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, because we also deal with this with our older, you know, older population that we mm-hmm. deal with, where, you know, some families say, you know, well, my pediatrician said, or I read that tongue tie is, you know, a fad and it's getting overdiagnosed. And, you know, for me, I try to educate them that I don't think that it's getting overdiagnosed. I think there are more diagnoses being made, but I think that's because there's more professionals out there seeking the training to truly understand the implications of tongue tie, even not even just in infancy, but past infancy into, yeah. you know, childhood and adulthood. Would you agree with that?
So I have a little bit of a different twist on that, because I think it's being underdiagnosed and overdiagnosed.
Okay.
And so when something becomes a social media, and, you know, I'm on Instagram as Tongue Tie Experts, and I do very well over there. So I'm not saying we shouldn't be on social. But when you have people saying, quick fix, baby had a tongue tie, look, this is a tongue tie, going and getting the tongue tie fixed, we may be having procedures done for the wrong reasons. We may be having procedures done when it wasn't prepared for. We may be having procedures done that, yes, maybe there's a frenum there that's visible, but maybe that's not the problem.
Right.
So, right. So, or then you're going to have all these stories of, oh yes, I had my baby's tongue tie released and it didn't even help.
Right.
And those are the kids your population is going to see older, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Who, oh yeah, my baby had a tongue tie released. It yep. didn't work and it didn't help with breastfeeding, but it's done. There's no tongue tie. You know, so yeah, we get that. We get that too. So I think it's very complicated. I think this is one of the challenges, because there's all levels of providers.
Right.
There are all, you know, And, you know, I used to send a baby right away. So I used to be that person. So, you know, we know better, we do better. And I think our practices are all evolving, and we get the best help we can get as parents, right, at the time. So if we are not, if we're not being cautious about who gets procedures, not being ready for it, not having aftercare, things like that, it's going to give the profession a bad name. And it's probably being overdone in certain areas. So that brings me to my most, you know, my biggest soapbox is this is a functional assessment.
Right.
Right. This is an assessment of how is that oral cavity, that tongue, all the muscles around it working for the function that it needs to perform. And for an infant, that's breastfeeding and breathing, right? So it's not about what it looks like. It's what it does.
Right.
Right. So for that reason, I don't even let pictures. I run a large Facebook group for parents and pros, and I don't even let pictures in the group because I will not do, is this a tongue tie? Is this a lip tie? I can't tell you by looking at it. Right. I can only tell by how it works because I've seen some of the worst looking anterior ties work just well. Just beautifully for breastfeeding. No pain, effective milk transfer, no symptoms, and everything's fine.
Yep.
And then I've seen ones that you can't even see the frenum because it's so posterior and restricted, but the tongue can't lift at all. And the baby can't even get on the breast. So you can't go by what it looks like.
Right. I just feel like it's too gray. Like there's not, people are looking for this clear cut answer all the time. And it's not, because there's all different varieties of the way that patients present when they have tethered oral tissues. I want to talk about, you had mentioned, you know, lip ties as well in there. You know, I hear back and forth from lactation communities about their feelings on lip ties. I actually was just at I was speaking at an ENT conference about myofunctional therapy, and there was a doctor speaking on tethered oral tissues from an ENT standpoint, saying how lip ties have no impact on breastfeeding.
Okay.
And that's, I was great. Eyes were like.
Yeah. Well, first, kudos to you for speaking at an ENT conference.
Thank you. Yes. It was
because that's big, because that's a tough community.
Yes.
So I think, you know, we know what we learn in school, and ENTs don't learn about lips. That's number one. What I like to do sometimes is turn it around. If that ENT was a woman who ever breastfed, I would like to say, you know, how would you feel if a baby could only curl the lip in on your breast? Like, let's try that. See how you like it. Right. I feel that. I mean, the tongue tie might be a more significant kind of restriction, but the lip tie sometimes causes more problems.
Okay.
Meaning more pain, especially if it's really, really, really tight. Right. And then we get into the whole conversation of buckle ties, which is a whole another can of worms. But as far as the lip tie goes, I always say if there's a lip tie, there's a tongue tie, almost always. But I have had a couple of babies that only had the lip released and things got better.
Okay.
So will that baby maybe someday need a tongue tie release? Possibly. But for now, things are okay. And you got to work, you know, back to that individual basis.
Yep.
You do things as you need to individually for each individual case. I do see a lot of tightness in lips that I say maybe if we had a lot of body work or if we did some CST on the head, you know, maybe it will loosen up. But sometimes we don't have time for that.
Right.
Because this is a newborn that needs nourishment, and mom can't put the baby to breast because her nipples are literally falling off. I mean, I've seen it, you know, so we need to take each individual basis. Like last week I had a baby that I said to them, you know what? I don't usually say go right for release, but this baby needs to be released. we might have to release more later because sometimes right. that happens too. Yep. But for now, let's do this for now and see what happens. Mm-hmm. But I also said, but don't listen to me. Here's all the education about it. And you talk to, they actually had a friend who was a release provider. So they were going to talk to her about it and see what's up. This is an example. She said to me, I'm going to try and wait for the release. And even the release provider is very conservative. She said that she would wait and she should go to an osteopath and then come back. So the mom messaged me and she's like, well, now the baby's nursing. I got her on the breast that time. And like 6 hours later, I got another text that said, so what treatment should I do for sore nipples?
Ah.
Right? So the baby, she didn't have pain because the baby was not latching at all before. Right. And now all of a sudden the baby is latching, but it's causing her a lot of pain.
Right.
So sometimes we can't wait. Sometimes we can.
Now I just want to go back to the buckles for a little bit because half of our listeners are professionals, half of our listeners
right.
are lay people. So some people might not even know what you mean by buckle. So
okay.
If you want to talk about what the buckle ties are and what you believe they can or cannot impact.
Okay. So the buckle ties are attachments in the cheek. Buckle literally means cheek. And it could be up and down. You can have one on each side. Sometimes it's when you see really cute dimples, it's actually a restriction. It's a frenum, which a frenum, for those who don't know, is the piece of tissue that attaches one thing to another in the body. So the lip tie is a frenum that's too tight right under the lip. A tongue tie is under the tongue, can be too tight, not elastic enough, or in the wrong place for the tongue to move efficiently. And the buckle ties are in the cheeks, and you can have up to four of them, one on each side, top and bottom, or that's what I know of. I think theoretically you could have more. I mean, I've seen double lip ties. I've seen all kinds of things, but people started to notice that there were some babies whose restrictions were released at the lip and the tongue, and they still had difficulty making a nice wide mouth for nursing or even on the bottle. So this isn't just for breastfeeding. Mm-hmm. Tongue-tied babies often have a problem with bottle feeding too. So I don't know who started looking at these cheek frenum and realized that if you lasered those two, it gave more flexibility in the mouth. Now, jury's still out, really, about this, because this is really relatively new. And I don't typically say that we should release them unless I see a lot of tension around the mouth that doesn't seem related, you know, like those small mouth babies. Like sometimes you'll hear stories of the doctor said that my baby couldn't breastfeed because my nipples were really big and my baby's mouth was really small.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as humans, we're meant to nurse to survive.
Right.
So I like to throw it back at the doctor and say, well, what should we, you know, what are we going to do here? What do you think's not, you know, and sometimes they come up with these like, you know, kind of, oh, she'll grow into your nipple or some
yeah.
sort of like that. So that's part of it. Like it'll help open things up a little more. Interesting. This is a very interesting point about buckles. Sometimes things change after body work, both ways. So if anyone who follows me, they hear me talk about my grandson. My grandson's going to be 2 in January. Not sure when this podcast is coming out, but he's going to be 2 in January. And he's been an adventure. He's been like the case of my life. But interesting with him was that he did not have buckle ties. But when he had reattachment under his tongue and one buckle tie formed after everything. And we had everybody working on him. I had PT, OT, chiropractor. We tried everyone because of who I am, right?
Of course, of course.
And my daughter still struggled. And, you know, it was a journey even with that. So even with all the support that I could give and all the providers that I know and the one of the best in the field doing the actual release, he had reattachment and a buckle tie was there that wasn't there before on one side.
Wow.
So things shift, right?
Right.
So I don't know that we should be lasering every buckle tie we see, but if everything else was done and that seems to be restricted, literally you could see that restriction when the baby's trying to eat, then maybe it's worth a try.
Right. And I think to your point, like the importance of multidisciplinary care, because it sounds, parents get this false information from whether it's from social media or reading online that like you said, it's a quick fix. Go get your baby's tongue tie release and everything's going to be beautiful. And it's not. And even for the kids and adults that I treat, I mean, myo and the release aren't enough. Like they still need body work. A lot of the kids. You know, we're always recommending some form of manual therapy. So giving them just that education so that they know, like, look, it's not just this one simple thing. Mm-hmm. And everybody responds differently to your, like how you were just talking about your son. Now, what about, as we're going through medical histories, we hear this a lot, and I know that you hear it a lot in your practice. So many people traditionally view colic and reflux as a diagnosis over an actual symptom of something that's going on. So can you speak a little bit further on that and how you're seeing that more as a symptom and something that you need to really evaluate the root cause for?
Absolutely. It's a symptom. Colic, well, let's take them separately. Colic just means crying excessively. And babies don't cry for no reason. They always cry for a reason. So way back when, I was at a conference by a famous lactation doctor whose name, it was a male doctor, and I'm not going to mention his name, but anybody who knows him will know this. And he said, colic ends at 3 months. So if you just do things to get them to 3 months, and then, you just keep giving them things to do, like very dismissively gaslighting all mothers, right? So that didn't feel right to me. So I started really researching about it and what is colic and what causes it and why would babies be crying all the time? They cry to have their needs met. And I think colic goes along with, well, there's a few reasons, but in our culture, let's get back to social media. The biggest goal for so many people is to get their baby to sleep, get their baby to be independent. And those first 3 months should be considered the fourth trimester. That baby needs to be close to its mom, right? And when it's not, it's going to cry. And maybe that baby needs to be closer to that mom in the early evening hours when colic is. Maybe that's because baby's reacting to mother's stress at that time of the day, right? So that's number one. We just meet their needs and they're usually okay. There are some babies that are high need that even that is not enough. And something might be going on. Maybe they're in pain, right? Babies, that's the only way they express their pain is crying, right? So that can get to the reflux aspect of it. Because if they're having a reflux issue, that could cause pain. Or maybe it's, maybe they're having difficulty nursing, so it's painful for them. Or maybe, and this sometimes gets people upset when I say this, but I would say that 50% of the people that come to me that say their baby is gassy and colicky, that baby is hungry and not getting enough. And they're trying everything else to do.
Right.
And not feeding the baby more. So I'm a lactation consultant, and you would not believe the amount of babies that I suggest supplementation for, whether it be mom's own breast milk, donor milk, or formula. Right. Because these babies are hungry. And that's the number one reason they cry is, discomfort or hunger. So yeah. It's a symptom. It's not a diagnosis. And colic, reflux, the same in most cases. Yes. Are there some babies with an immature sphincter that's going to reflux no matter what you do? Yes. But the majority of reflux diagnoses is aeriphagia, meaning the baby is swallowing air when they're nursing or taking a bottle. And that comes from not being able to have a good seal, not being able to lift their tongue efficiently and nurse efficiently, or even not getting enough, because when they're not transferring milk enough, when the milk supply is low, or they don't have the ability to effectively transfer milk, they're necessarily going to get more air as they're nursing from the breast or the bottle. And the air's got to go somewhere. right? So if we think about the body as the GI system, simply as a tube that starts in the mouth and ends in the rectum, the air has to go somewhere. Mm-hmm. I put in the symptoms along with reflux on the other end. It could be explosive poops or smelly poops or green poops. Mm-hmm. Not always tongue tie, but it could be because that air's got to go somewhere. Right. So any of those three, the digestive issues overlap and sometimes coincide with food allergies, food intolerances. So it's tricky, but if other signs are there and that's going on, it's possible it's the tongue tie.
Now, you had mentioned earlier, low milk supply. Is there a correlation between low milk supply and a tongue tie? And not to say that every mom with low milk supply has a baby that's tongue tied, but is there a correlation?
There definitely is a correlation because if a baby is nursing and not removing milk, then there will be less milk made. So breastfeeding, lactation works on demand and supply system. The more that's removed, the more that is made. Mm-hmm. So this is a wonderful question. So if a we can get all into the pumping issue because pumping is one of those things where it's overdone and underdone, right? Mm-hmm. So a little bit of history. It's only in the past few years that everybody gets a pump from their insurance. Well, most people get a pump from their insurance company covered by insurance, which was a wonderful thing. But when it first happened, everybody thought that they had to start pumping right away. Right. So it was like this whole, like, I got this pump. I got to try it. People were bringing them to the hospital, pumping in the hospital. And that's not necessary and can actually be a problem. So the message went out what to not pump before 3 to 4 weeks.
Okay.
Right. But that was the wrong message because they forgot the last half of the message. Unless your baby's not nursing efficiently. Mm-hmm. So doctors were telling and nurses in the hospital were telling their patients, don't pump, give formula. You can't pump before 3 weeks. Like, no, if you can't feed your baby at the breast or the baby's feeding inefficiently, you must pump. Mm-hmm. Otherwise your body's going to get the message not to make milk.
Right.
So yes, a baby who has difficulty feeding, whose mother is not pumping, may have a problem. The mother may have a decrease in supply. The other thing that happens interestingly with breastfed babies is sometimes they do well until like 3 or 4 months, and then the supply drops because the hormonal impetus for the milk to come lasts 3 to 4 months. And then it becomes more of a, if you don't remove it, it won't be made kind of thing. So you see babies falling off the curve between 3 and 5 months, usually the curve, like all of a sudden it's like, wait a minute. Matter of fact, I got a call today that I got to return. My baby was doing fine. And all of a sudden she's off her growth curve. Okay. And then it's like, you go backwards in the history, like you were talking about before. Oh, it was painful. My nipples were bleeding. The baby's been throwing up since birth and all the stuff is there. Right. But yeah, the other thing is there's biologic individuality among women who are trying to make milk. There are some women that will make tons of milk no matter what you do. And there are others that we do in all the things right and they'll have low milk supply.
Right.
So there's that variation there. So some milk supplies are more resilient than mm-hmm. others. So there's a continuum there, right? It's not all or none. And then on the other side of it, is the oversupply moms. Believe it or not, I see a lot of very, very chubby babies who are nursing all the time, who are getting overfed, and they have a tongue tie because the milk is just like a water fountain for them.
Right.
You know, so
I never thought about it that way. Cause you know, I'm thinking about my nephew. I mean, he's 8 now, but he was tongue tied as a baby, did not get released till he was 5 years old. But he was the chubbiest. I mean, rolls upon rolls, like mm-hmm. the chubbiest baby. And like, it was, you know, painful for my sister-in-law and, you know, all that jazz. And she knows now and her other two kids are released and whatnot. But I never thought about that it's literally, if an oversupply doesn't matter. It's just gonna, it's just gonna
come out.
Now, this is, I don't know that this is a tongue tie question. I don't think it is, but it's a question that I have anyways. So I have, again, we talked about this earlier before. I'm at the age where everybody around me is having babies and whatnot. So I see and hear a lot of things. Yeah, I have a friend right now who, you know, was dead set, wanted to breastfeed only for 6 months or so or whatever. Or maybe it was 4 months. I don't know. Anyway, she was going back to work and now is trying to introduce the bottle, and like the baby will not take a bottle. Mm-hmm. And I have another friend who made it a point to introduce the bottle after I forget how many weeks, just once a day.
Right.
So that the baby gets used to it. So when she went back to work, it wouldn't be an issue. Is there a way to go about that? Or
this is a good question. And I wish I had an easy answer for this. Again, everything's individual. I actually had in my own experience that my son would take a bottle, and this is, he's 32, right? So I did everything wrong. I didn't know anything back then. Literally, I always tell people, I don't do this because I got it all right. I do this because I wish there was somebody to teach me. You know, I try to be the teacher I wish I had.
Yep.
I did everything wrong. We used to give sugar water.
Right.
Sugar water in a bottle, right? So anyway, I digress. He took bottles, he nursed. I don't know that my milk ever came in fully because I wasn't doing anything right, but he did get some breast milk, and he's a pretty healthy kid. But he, as I was trying to give him more bottles because I was going back to work, he started refusing them. He was like that smart. He's like, no, I want the breast. Like he was like 2.5 months,
right?
And he started refusing bottles, and he had them from birth. So,
okay.
But it's a red flag for tongue tie if your baby can't take a bottle at all. Mm-hmm. And again, my grandson example, he could not take a bottle. He couldn't suck on my finger. Not just my finger. He couldn't suck on a finger.
Yeah.
My daughter had a copious supply. She's one of those lucky ones, and it worked. Right. But if she didn't decide to breastfeed and bring her milk in, she didn't have milk, my grandson would have been a tube fed baby. Because he could not suck on anything. He could not leave a pacifier in his mouth.
Wow.
Not that you need to, but that was like a test for him. Maybe it's not my finger. Let's try the pacifiers. The Ninny pacifier that everybody loves, he could not even hold it in his mouth.
Wow.
So when he did, I knew we had progress. You know, like that was one of my therapies that I used with him. But so you don't know for sure, but if a baby is breastfeeding fine, quote unquote, and all of a sudden you're trying to introduce a bottle and it won't work. It could be the wrong bottle. It could be a tongue tie, right? So that's worth an evaluation with an IBCLC. And that brings me to a really vital part of this, that only an IBCLC can evaluate the mother and the baby together. Most of the professions are not trained to do that. And the IBCLC is the highest. It's like the gold standard for lactation. There's lots and lots and lots of alphabet soup in your field and mine, right? Mm-hmm. But there is a huge difference between a CLC and an IBCLC as far as education and experience and qualifications. And, you know, I had to just retake the test last year to stay in IBCLC. Yeah. It's vigorous.
Yeah.
The LSERPs, the education that we do, I mean, it's really, really, really tough to become and stay in IBCLC. So we are the breastfeeding experts, the infant feeding experts, even bottle feeding in the beginning. Mm-hmm. Myself, because I don't have as much experience learning in my education about bottle feeding, I collaborate with a speech language pathologist who's a feeding therapist for babies who are bottle feeding or mixed feeding, who I feel like I can't help them. So again, interdisciplinary collaboration, even on this level. But even if you're seeing a well-meaning feeding therapist, if you're a breastfeeding parent, the evaluation has to be done by a lactation consultant, because she can't, that SLP can't evaluate mom.
Right.
Or the interaction between mom and baby.
Yep. Right. And that was going to be my next question, is how, you know, we talked about baby the whole episode.
Right. Right.
Sure that we're also considering mom in the equation of everything.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And I have a whole thing all about preparedness for phrenotomy considering mom. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you'll let me, you know, we're going to have some link in the chat, in the notes, because my What About Mom is my latest soapbox. You know, parents go through a lot, and I know you're young and trying to start a family. I don't want to scare you, but there's so much birth trauma now. Right. Really, like, you hear people who have, they come out of birth with stories like they didn't expect. Things are happening. There's a lot of separation of babies. Since COVID, things have been really hard because, I mean, everything in the medical system has changed since COVID,
right.
And priorities have shifted. And anyway, it's just not as fun as it once was. So I would say that we have to think about what the parents in general have been through, but especially mom physically. She's just gone through birth. Mm-hmm. She's trying to do this thing that she thought was going to be just a natural thing coming to her easily, which is breastfeeding. She planned on breastfeeding, and now she's got this baby and probably not getting much help in the hospital and getting mixed ideas and mixed signals and not sleeping. The partner's not sleeping, family pressures, maybe other kids. And they come to the professional to say, well, what can you do to help me? And instead of me showing them how to hold the baby, I'm doing all that. And then I'm telling them, by the way, your baby has a defect and you have to have surgery.
Right.
Wow. Right. Like, it's like getting hit when you're down.
Yep.
So we have to remember that, and we have to be gentle and, you know, have grace and patience for the families, and also give them very clear cut ways to be prepared for the actual procedure. So I talk about, even in my checklist, I say, have meals ready.
Right.
Right. Because who would think of that? Right. Like, right. You're going to come home with a baby. You're upset. No matter how easy the procedure goes, it's upsetting. Probably driving a distance, because most people drive far to get these providers. And then you're going to come home, you're exhausted, you're hangry, your partner's tired from driving, all the things. And now you don't even have a meal. And the other thing is to talk about what you're going to do for that baby's pain relief for analgesia. Get that provider's recommendation before the procedure so you can have it ready for you. So those are just some of the things that we think about. Childcare for other kids.
Yeah.
You know, things that, like, as a healthcare provider, we don't think of the family system.
Right.
Right. We just like do this, do that, do that. But you want to think about, this is a family that's, you know, having some stress.
Right. And it's going to impact the whole family, to your
yes.
point.
Yes. And now we're going to tell them they have to do stretches and exercises with this baby that's going to make the baby scream. So we really have to have some grace for the parents. Realize, and I hate saying this because it feels like I'm being condescending, but I'm not. I'm being honest. They don't absorb. If you're sleep deprived, iron deficient, you're not going to absorb stuff. So only expect the family to absorb half of what you're telling them.
Yeah.
Literally. Yep. I mean, I know that because I get questions like, wait, I wrote that down in your note. Did you read it?
Right.
You know,
right.
You know. So it's that, it's hard. It's really, really hard. And it's time for us to realize that and realize the emotional aspect of what it's like to hand your baby over and say, do this thing to my baby, no matter how simple and quick it is.
Oh my
it's
God,
still hard. Absolutely. It's still
I'll
hard.
Never forget one night I get a text message from my cousin, and she's like cheersing a cocktail, and I'm like, what's this for? And she's like, today was the last day of stretches. She's like, yay for me.
Yeah, it's a big deal. It's a really big deal. And, you know, getting back to what we were saying before about research, we don't even know what's the right protocol.
Right.
We're still figuring that out. And we used to do a lot worse. Mm-hmm. A lot worse when I first came into this field, of how often we were stretching, we were rubbing under the wound, we were doing nasty things.
Yeah.
You know, and we didn't know that we didn't need to do that. I don't feel like I did anything wrong. I did what I thought was the right thing.
Right. Of course.
Right. And maybe 5 years from now, it'll be a whole different protocol. Right. but it's hard no matter what. So, and I don't, you know, any parents listening, I don't want to be discouraging to you. I'm being respectful. You know, I'm trying to be respectful of the
parent. And realistic too,
because
you, I mean, I think that any parent would want to have realistic expectations for what is going to be, what their role is going to be. Mm-hmm. So I think we have to be this way. And I don't think it's, you know, being rude at all or, you know,
I just don't want to scare anybody. Them.
No, of course. You know? I think, you know, because then oftentimes, you know, you hear these families like, I didn't know that I was going to, I didn't know I had to do all of this. I didn't know how important the stretches were. So, you know, again, having forums like this where I said to you, I'm so excited to have this episode because I'm at the age, like my cousin just texted me the other day, her friend's friend thinks that her baby's tongue tied. She doesn't know what to do. She doesn't know who to call, you know, and they all come to me because they know
that I
have resources for them.
Right. And you know what, Brittany, that's another point that I make. I mean, you're not, you know, not to, you know, put you down, but it's not in your scope.
Right.
And there are some providers that are stepping over their scope. So parents should know that if it's a baby or a child under about the age of 4, it shouldn't be someone who's just a myofunctional therapist and not a speech language pathologist or an IBCLC. Mm-hmm. Because that, as you know, myofunctional therapy is something you can voluntarily do, you know, and you know, you can't voluntarily tell a baby to do exercises. You can do motor exercises, you can do oral exercises, but you're doing it to the baby. So that's by definition not myofunctional therapy.
Right.
So I think that's an important point. And most of, you know, any IBCLC who's worth their weight in anything who has training or claims to know about tongue tie will be able to give simple exercises to do to help strengthen the tongue and the oral cavity and have a network of people that they refer to that understand as well. Like I said before, I work closely with an SLP, but I think that it's really important for different disciplines to learn together and understand what each other's roles are. Like I took a myofunctional therapy course. Mm-hmm. Technically I could do it on, you know, the right age, I didn't take it because I want to hang that shingle out. I took it so that I understand what you do. On the same vein, my professional course is open to all professionals, not just IBCLCs, because I think everyone should know what I know, not to go practice it, but just to know, understand what I do and know when to refer to me, be able to talk to the family about what we do for, you know,
that more because I mean, I see, yes, older kids, but a lot of them have young siblings or babies, infant siblings, and mom doesn't even know that she's going to come to this appointment and these thoughts are going to be sparked. And then she's like, you know, so it's so important. I was just having this conversation with a OT last week, actually, we met for coffee. And I'm like, I don't know why. Sometimes I feel like some professionals get very territorial of their profession, where we need to be more opening and welcome, because then we're able to get these patients to the right providers at the right time. You know,
And collaboration is imperative for patient care.
Absolutely.
And you know, the team approach. I've been preaching the team approach since since I started this work because that's how I learned. Yeah. You know, I learned from other disciplines. It's you know, this learning in silos stuff does not work anymore.
Now, where could people find you if they want to learn more? What are some links that they can visit? And we will.
So we have my website where everything is there is tonguetieexperts.net. So it's not .com, it's .net. Somebody stole .com before I got to. I don't know who's got it. I'm Tongue Tie Experts on Instagram and Facebook. And the Facebook group is called Breastfeeding Tongue Tied Babies. And it's a great interdisciplinary learning place. And it's well moderated because there's a lot of Facebook groups that are like, I call them the Wild West, you know, especially in parents groups. So this is well moderated. Nothing gets posted without myself or my admin friends, you know, helping me out. No, nothing gets up there that shouldn't be there. And we're very carefully monitoring the comments. So it's a safe space. And the other thing is, if somebody's looking for a provider who has graduated from my course, on my website, I have a professional referral list now. So anybody who graduates from my course, if they want to, they can be listed. So that's, it's not as many students are in it yet because they haven't submitted for it, but it's a growing list of different places in the world and different professionals who have graduated from the Professional's Guide to Tongue Tie.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to come and chat with me. This was just a wealth of knowledge. I can't wait to get the episode out, and link all your, all of Lisa's social media links and all that good stuff in the show notes. So thank you again for coming on.
Thank you, Brittany. Have a great day.
You too. Thank you for listening to today's episode of I Spy with My Maya Y. If you want to hear more about these episodes, leave a review on Apple Podcasts or feel free to contact me at hello@myctom.com. Don't forget to subscribe as well and let us know of any subject or guest speaker you'd like to hear from. Help spread the word by sharing today's episode on your social media page. You can find me on Facebook at CT Oral Facial Myology or Instagram handle CT_oralfacial_myology. Everybody have a wonderful day.